Welcome to Open Curtain. While there are many technical challenges to creating great photographs, there are many life challenges to being an artist. Join me as I talk with working photographers about what they've had to do to support their passion and the complexity of creating work that matters using the most popular medium of today. Janet Delaney is most known for her first project, which documents the 1980s gentrification of a working-class neighborhood in San Francisco. That work was published in a book called South of Market by Mack in 2013. Since then, she's published another book, Public Matters, which includes photos of Bay Area parades and protests during the same time. Join us as we discuss the genesis of her career as an artist, her reasons for making civil work, and the importance of diversity in the art world. Well, thank you, Janet, for joining us here on Open Curtain.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Okay, so one way I like to start every episode is asking each photographer what they wanted to be when they grew up.
You know, I didn't have a lot of examples when I was growing up about what I could be. And I think my first concept about an occupation was, ironically enough, very aspirational. I wanted to be an architect. I didn't know any architects. I didn't know any houses that had actually been built by architects, but we got the Los Angeles Times newspaper delivered to our house, and there was the home section in it. It was like a glossy magazine, and it would have house plans, and I would fantasize about these gorgeous houses with their house plans. So for some reason, I became obsessed with Frank Lloyd Wright. He was sort of my first hero. And I only say ironically because when it came time to actually take a class that would prepare me for such a task called drafting in high school, it was only for boys.
So were you the first female in your class?
No, I didn't take the class.
Oh.
I didn't think I could take it. I looked in there, it was all guys, and there was a kind of high-level math requirement. And I hadn't gotten that because my education had been a bit sketchy. And I'm really glad I'm not an architect, but I am still completely fascinated. And I ended up teaching in the architecture department at UC Berkeley for many years and married a contractor and spend a lot of social time with architects. So I guess it all worked out.
Yeah, so you kind of married into it in a way.
Yes.
So walk us through when you started taking pictures and when you started turning that into a career and how that evolved into making it an art form.
I think I was originally enamored by the idea of photography in 11th grade because the girl sitting next to me came into my class with her wet black and white prints from the lab. And every day I'd ask her what she had done the day before. So 12th grade, I took that class. And really, it was like falling in love and getting, you know, committed at a very early age, which is not an uncommon story for photographers. But I think I was, 17 when I first realized the power of the medium. And I'm still struggling to try to figure it out. It's an endlessly fascinating format. So that was my first step. I pretty much organized my education around trying to study photography. I went initially to a community college that primarily had filmmaking, so I took filmmaking classes. It was in Los Angeles, and it was fabulous because there were all these really great professors or teachers from Hollywood who were looking for day jobs to support their art form. So I got a good basis, but I wanted still photography. So I ended up at the College of Marin, another community college, that had a really good program. I studied there with some really amazing fellow students who went on to do great things. Catherine Wagner was also in school with me at that point in 1971. And from there, the natural next step would have been San Francisco State. It sounds like such a humble place when you think about Yale or all these other possibilities. But in 1970, San Francisco State was really a epicenter of photographic effort. It was the West Coast center for all things photographic. And so I migrated from Marin, just across the Golden Gate Bridge, over to San Francisco State.
And how were you able to support yourself? Did you have some support system? Were you working odd jobs to afford all this?
Well, as a undergraduate at San Francisco State in the 1970s, I think tuition was $90 a semester. and I think rent was about $50 a month. I had to work the whole time to pay my way. So I worked as a baker in a natural foods restaurant called Shandy Gaff in San Francisco on Polk Street. So I would get up at, you know, 2 or 3 in the morning and make like 40 loaves of bread and 5 or 6 cakes and pies and a big thing of soup. And then I would go to class. Yeah. So I always worked. I always worked in the kitchen. When I ultimately graduated with my degree, it was 1975. There was a major recession and I was pretty unemployable. I mean, my skill sets were minimal other than making a really good black and white print. And I really hadn't gotten any kind of education that would allow me to make a living. So I did ultimately hobble together some community jobs. And then I went to bartending school. And I wasn't a drinker. I never spent any time in a bar, but it seemed like I'd make more money mixing drinks than making bread. So I got a job. I was one of the first women, if not the first woman, to be hired at the Hyatt Regency in about 1978 in San Francisco. Yeah, the wages were pretty minimal. But ultimately, I saved up enough money to take a very defining trip through Central America. I had a close friend who traveled through India, and he would say, you really need to get out of the United States and see what's going on in other places. I'd never traveled, and so I couldn't really afford to go to India. So I figured I could take the bus to Mexico, and I basically traveled for 6 months through Central America with a medium format camera and a big tripod, and I went and studied Spanish really intensely, and then I just continued my journeys till I was almost out of film, and finally got so homesick, I just got back on the bus and started working in a lab doing photographic color printing, thinking it would be a good foundation for making a living. I've always have had a certain pragmatism. I mean, I was raised pretty, you know, attentive to the needs of making my own living, so.
Yeah, you and me both have that in common.
Right. You got to figure it out. And so, you know, so I moved on to that and I went to work at Frog Prints. I worked there and I went to graduate school while I was there. So I was able to print my work for graduate school.
And what work were you making in grad school?
I think my first project was to do a piece on my father who sold beauty supplies to beauty shops. I went back down to Los Angeles and I spent a week with my old Nikon and a flash and a fancy tape recorder. And I just followed him around and interviewed him and photographed his interactions with the women in the various beauty shops and talked about what it was like to have that kind of work. And I made this 2-projector slideshow with a dissolve unit and sound synced up to it. So it was a high tech of the day. And I was very happy with that piece. I was very glad I'd done it because I was able to finally sort of understand what my father's work was. It was work that I'd always eschewed because I was very much influenced by the 60s anti-establishment, you know, feminist of the era. And there my father was selling this idea of beauty and the necessity for makeup and permanence and dyeing your hair. And so it was great for me to just get in there and see what it was he did and why he did it and how he did it. And anyway, that story was influenced by work that was being done by Connie Hatch at that time. She was a year ahead of me in grad school. And a lot of people were doing work like that. I think Carrie Mae Weems then eventually did something about her own family in that way. And there were a number of other artists that were using that two-projector slideshow as a framework for telling stories. It was, you know, before we could be online or do anything on the internet. So it was quite fun to see your still images become almost filmic.
Mm-hmm. And then after that, you started shooting South of Market. Tell us how you, or why you started making that work.
It became quite an obsession for me to document the community that I was living in, which was a light industrial kind of warehouse area that had a really incredible sense of diversity and had become the new home for artists and had also a big gay population. So there was a kind of freedom in that neighborhood for people to be what they needed to be, and that was likely based on the fact that it was not very expensive to live there, which was based on the fact that it wasn't very pretty and it didn't have any benefits. I mean, there were no services or restaurants or any of the accoutrements of city living that you would expect. You couldn't find a cup of coffee or a laundromat or anything. It was a warehouse district. But right. I moved into a little apartment next to a warehouse because they were all woven together from back in the day when they were constructed for being worker housing for the warehouses. And I started to interview, in the same way I had my father, my neighbors. And I started to photograph my neighbors. And a lot of that was based on the fact that I was fascinated with this huge construction site that was coming in to the center of my neighborhood, South of Market, the Moscone Center.
Yeah.
And I wondered, like, how was it going to impact my neighbors? What was going to happen when this convention center opened up?
Right. That was, in a way, the beginning of it all.
Well, it was certainly one of the key elements in the gentrification of San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
If they had opted to not do it that way, if they had opted to invest in this working class neighborhood and help to improve it as opposed to create a slum from a rather functioning working class neighborhood, things would have been quite different. But that's capitalism.
Right. So tell us what you had to do to be able to create that work and when you first showed it.
Going back to the beginning, I was able to get along with Connie Hatch. One of the NEA survey grants, National Endowment for the Arts, was supporting artists to make work about their communities. And this was sort of an offshoot from the bicentennial era. This was a time when the government was actually funding artists, individual artists, to make work. And the survey grants were sort of targeted at projects that would be part of our history in a way. So the South of Market project sort of fit right into it. And we wrote this grant together and then we worked on the project together. Connie didn't, she made one project, but she then moved to Los Angeles. So she didn't have the same sort of long-term relationship with it, but she's always been very supportive of what I did. We had an exhibition at San Francisco Camera Work right when the work was in production, about 1982, I think that show was, or 81. And it was a big show and it was hugely attended, and a lot of the community came into the gallery in a way that they never had before, because we were able to invite all these people that we'd met on the street and to talk to them about art as a way to acknowledge different ways of living in a city. And it was kind of groundbreaking in its own way. I got another grant from the National Endowment for that work, an independent one. So I continued working on that really until about 1986, at which point one of the earliest shows I had of the work was at a gay bar called The Ambush. My landlord was working at The Ambush, and so he organized for me to exhibit the work there. And those were the days when bars were full of smoke. And, you know, I had the work framed, but boy, when it came back a month or two later, it was just sticky, you know, by the days of cigarette smoke. And, you know, but the guys, it was kind of a gay leather bar of sorts. So that's mostly what they were in the South Market and still are. But they said, you know, I would meet these guys on the street sometimes when I was out shooting later, and they'd say, wow, that work was so interesting. We had no idea those things were happening in our neighborhood. You know, we mostly just have pornography on the walls and the bars. And so it was really refreshing to see the families and the workers. And so, you know, that was a very rewarding show. I just always have a very strong sense about the need to break down that framework that says where art should and should not be exhibited.
You know, the day destroys the night, night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide, break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, yeah.
Do you think the years you spent in the bakery and the bars really helped you gain access to these places?
Well, I grew up in a working class neighborhood in Compton in Los Angeles. And also my father was a salesman, you know. So I think when I watch my brother and sister out in the world, I see this sort of familiar feeling of never meeting a stranger, of sort of just being interested in everybody. And I guess I just inherited that openness from my dad, who sort of has that same social approach to things. I gain a lot of energy from strangers and from meeting people for the first time and trying to find out what they're about. And even though I don't think it's easy, I keep coming back to it. I always want to have those kinds of connections. And when I had children, which I still have, I mean, you know, when they were younger, they would sort of be a little chagrined at my ability to talk to people. They'd always want me to sort of silence and, you know, disappear. But now I would say the circumstances are so dramatically different. It first started with headphones, everybody having headphones, listening to their Walkmans or what have you. And then it went to cell phones. So they're not only headphones, but their eyes are now buried in their cell phone. And now they have a mask on. And boy, you know, it's really altered the way we experience.
An interesting evolution in socialization.
Yeah, people live in their own curated bubble now, I think. You know, they have their own piped in music or podcasts. Case in point.
Right.
You know, and their eyes are not, I mean, if you're looking at your cell phone, you're not in where you are. You look up and you go, oh, here I am crossing the street. Whoops.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
It makes doing street photography a lot more challenging.
You know, it's interesting what you said about the limitations we have today, because there were a couple decades between when you showed South of Market in the 80s and when we see it again in your book. Why was that? This work went unseen for so long.
So, you know, one wonders, why did I stop in 1986 for the South of Market project? I was trying to photograph what I thought was going to happen, which was gentrification and all of its glory, and everybody was going to be all fancy and fixed up, and the neighborhoods would look so different. And it didn't actually happen because the economy kept shifting and things weren't moving as fast as I thought they needed to. And so I put the project away and felt very much like, well, it was a good effort, but I'm going to let it go. And I got very involved in something else because I felt like I wanted to make my work have a strong political infrastructure to it, or to be in the service of an idea. And because of my travels through Central America and the fact that I spoke Spanish, I was invited down to Nicaragua in 1984 to photograph for Oxfam Tools for Peace project, that they were bringing farm tools to farmers from farmers across the United States. And I was photographing the distribution. But let's say, you know, if you had been living in San Francisco in the Mission District, which I was at that point in the mid-1980s, every ounce of all of our energy was focused towards the civil wars in Central America, in El Salvador, in Nicaragua, and the solidarity work that was being done was really powerful. And so I got very much involved in that kind of work. And through this time, I was teaching by now because I'd gotten my MFA and I had a part-time teaching job. And I also was working as a documentary photographer for a firm that did advocacy documentaries for nonprofits. So I would just be sent out on all of these curious assignments where I would be documenting things like childcare centers or new systems for sanitation workers or, you know, nonprofit medical agencies. And, you know, there was a whole variety of assignments that really taught me how to sort of just show up and make pictures. It wasn't quite journalism because they'd be a little bit more long term. And then I would make these two projector slideshows that they would use for fundraising for them.
It's interesting in your work that I think in any project that you take on, you try to help somebody with that work. Do you think that that is just your nature, or was there something in your life that happened that made you that way?
Well, you know, if you really look at my whole body of work, it's not 100% that way. There were a couple of very internal projects that did not have that same mandate, but I think that it is somehow so very rewarding when you can see your work functioning in some way. Being able to connect directly with the people that I would photograph was such a powerful element and such a motivator. I did not get a lot of commercial success as a fine artist, so I didn't have any obligations or support system in it. I certainly just felt that this way I would at least have some kind of a feedback loop, you know, having some audience, right? I always thought about the musicians that play in the subway. You know, you want an audience, mm-hmm. and so you do what you can to get it. And it's always a tricky thing. Like, was my work just not good enough to be in galleries, or was it really just that people didn't sort of have any interest in showing women's work?
Yeah, and a lot of it is just, you know, right time, right place.
Mm-hmm. Well, that could definitely be it. And also the culture. You know, still today, most galleries will have maybe 20-25% women.
Right.
And
at most.
At most, yeah, that would be exciting. So yeah, right. that was, and I wasn't really making work that was resonating in that way. So, and I was all right with that. But then, you know, in 1986, as I was doing the Nicaraguan work, I met my husband. He was doing construction and I was doing fundraising for the construction brigade that he was involved with in Nicaragua. And once we got together, we got married and had children pretty quickly. We were both in our mid to late 30s, so it was time to just kind of seize the moment. And I was kind of put into an altered state because I'd had such an independent and free life as a single person up until I was 34. So being all of a sudden at home with a baby was quite challenging. And I didn't have any, you know, support other than Bill was great, but it wasn't like I had family. I certainly didn't have babysitters. And so I would teach at night and I would try to get my classes done during the day and take care of Johanna, my first daughter. So I really feel for all these people that are in quarantine now trying to get all this done when you have a baby at home.
But yeah, it's interesting how your motherhood for you is similar to what now everyone's dealing with.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it has always been difficult. You know, we're only just mm-hmm. now being able to pay attention to it. But
right.
I did this whole project called Housebound, mm-hmm. where I just realized, okay, I can't go anywhere. So what can I do at home? And I shifted to a Hasselblad and studio lights, thinking, well, maybe I could learn how to do them well enough to get a job. And I started doing wedding photography on the weekends when I could get away and leave the house and go out and photograph weddings, which was, on one hand, great. You know, I love a party, but it was also incredibly exhausting and challenging work, as everybody who's ever done it will know. And I didn't quite ever do it enough to feel like I had it wired. Well, so that I did Housebound, and then after Housebound, I went back to another thing that I'd always wanted to do, which was landscape work. And I had started off doing some of that back when I was first in grad school. And I found this incredible solace in being alone in the wilderness. And I had so few opportunities. I would sort of organize my family's trips so that I would work my way into a scenario that was conducive to making photographs. And I started focusing on trees and their various states of interaction with one another. They became sort of metaphors for my state of mind, you know, from quite you know, Tangled to ultimately, you know, Carefully Seen. And I watched over a number of years how those photographs changed as I changed and how I approached the subject matter. I did it for about 10 years, and I'd only get to do it a little bit of time every year when I could be out in the woods. Although I ultimately decided that wilderness was a state of mind and it didn't have to be, you know, a formally defined wilderness. It could just be along the side of the road. But I was obsessed with it, and I couldn't get enough of it. And I really love that body of work, but it hasn't really seen daylight very much.
Maybe the right time.
Yeah, it's not, come along. Yeah. I have a tendency to let things sit for a while.
So how are you dealing with COVID, and how are you creating work, and what are you creating?
I took on a task that I had been wanting to and starting to do before COVID, but now actually became much easier, and that was to do interviews through Zoom with a number of key people and people that I just knew in the community of Soma, from, you know, school teachers to tech workers to city planners, storekeepers, like all kinds of different characters that make a city a city. So I have all these transcriptions of these interviews that I've been doing. And I've gone back and photographed some, but initially it was with some trepidation, although now I think I feel more clear about how to navigate the world. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to set up to do more portraiture, which is what I'd intended when I got the Guggenheim. The intention was to bring this project to its completion by doing a lot of interior photographs of people's homes and workplaces and portraiture. So both of those things become much more complicated by the virus. So part of me is sort of waiting, and part of me is trying to navigate a new way to approach it.
Yeah, it's hard to create work when so much of your work and your way of making work is going out in the world, when you can't do that anymore.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, I think making is the operative word there, and I'm always making something, you know, no matter what form it takes. So,
yeah. So can you tell us about how South of Market gained interest of Mac and the De Young Museum? You know, what was the process for all that?
That was very interesting, and it really is. I want to start right at the very beginning, in the sense that I've always been pretty connected to camera work, which is an alternative gallery space. Historically, it started in the early 70s. I started going when it opened, and it has been a cornerstone of photography in San Francisco all these years, and it was therefore part of the history of that gallery. Mm-hmm. Different directors had come through over the time. And the director that was current at that moment was in about 2013, was putting together a retrospective of their work. And he was talking to Bob Dawson, who said, well, what about Janet Delaney? How come you haven't got her in this? And he didn't know about my work. So I mention that because at this moment in time, when we're all working so hard to address a lot of the social inequalities that happen, even just through omission, through people not making an effort to speak up for people who might not be as represented. Mm-hmm. If Bob Dawson had not said to Chuck Mobley, what about Janet Delaney, it wouldn't have happened, you know? And yeah. So I just think that sense of anyone with any position needs to always expand and pay attention to putting a hand out to others who could use a hand up, right? Because I think we sometimes get tired, or we don't think, or we don't pay attention, or we're so busy with our own sense of what we need for ourselves. At any given point, there are 10 people around you who would just love it if you would get in touch with them and say, hey, have you thought about such and such? Or what about applying for this or that? Or I'm going to mention your name to so-and-so. So anyway, I'd never had a curator come to my studio. And I was like close to 60 by now. And I'd never had a gallery or any kind of recognition. I'd had those grants, which were phenomenal, but I'd never sold any work or had any other kind of acknowledgement.
Yeah, and, but you had been creating work the entire time.
Oh, yeah. And so when Chuck came over to my studio, he was so encouraging. And he then said, oh, I have to show this work to a curator at the SF MoMA, which was Erin O'Toole.
Oh, wow.
And then she said, wow, you know, I love this South of Market work. When are you going to get it published? And I had said I'd love to get the work published since I had created it in the 80s, but I had no way to do it. I knew nobody who had ever had a book done personally. And I was clueless to the system, and I had no access or any sense of how one would proceed. So I just said, yes, let's do it, right? I think I also would say I have an idea of yes and, you know, just I have a just say yes policy to most opportunities, because right. I think it's just important to participate. I don't get super hierarchical about it. But I would say that Erin was pivotal in helping me to get that book out. But, you know, luck doesn't happen if you don't have the material to back it up. But at any rate, I did the hard work that it took to get the South of Market negatives scanned and got those negatives printed up and made a book dummy with blurb. And she took that book to Perry Photo and showed it to Michael Mack. And he said, yes, he wanted to make the book. So I was fortunate in that I didn't have to, you know, search a whole bunch of different people. I just had to wait 30 years.
Yeah.
It's tricky because if I had been a white man, I would have had much more success in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And so I can't say that easily. I can say that I didn't have any mentors and I didn't have access to the kinds of systems that would have allowed me to have had success earlier in my career. Now, why did I not have those things? I'm not sure.
And what did your mother do? Did she work?
She was brilliant and had to drop out of college because of the Depression. So she only got a couple years or 1 year of college and went to business school. So she worked as an accountant's assistant for almost minimum wage for about 20 years. And I would say, Mom, you should really ask for a raise. It's 1975 and you're making $3 an hour, you know? But she didn't have the nerve to ask for a raise, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, my mother was a really strong, forceful person, but she was not one of the, you know, small percentage of very successful women of that era. There were successful women. You know, I could name many, but she was more of her era, you know, and I didn't really have role models that much. I mean, Judy Dater was very successful, but there were not a lot of women in my immediate community. Catherine Wagner was very successful. There were a handful, just enough to make me feel like it was my own fault. If I had only done better, I would have been more successful.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are those things that do actually restrict us from succeeding. And then there are also obstacles that we create for ourselves.
Yeah. Well, how do you ever know when it was a personal obstacle you created for yourself or something that the larger societal framework set you
up for? I guess. Yeah. That reminds me of a quote I love that actually Wayne Gretzky said, which is, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take.
Yeah, well, that's very much the case.
Yeah, but it's not that simple, too. I mean, going back to what you were saying about your mother not being able to ask for a raise, you can't say that it doesn't hurt to ask, because it does.
Yeah, no, the vulnerability is so strong. And so while I knew I needed to do something, it was not really obvious to me how to take things into my own hands and how to make my life happen, although eventually I was able to do it through tenacity. And, you know, and I think it's why I'm so committed to trying to, you know, extend that out to other people.
So tell us about what it was like when you found out you got your Guggenheim?
That was pretty exciting. It's something I had, I applied a couple times. So it was my third time. And I always think about these applications as being very important to help you assess where you're at and to take stock of, you know, what you're really trying to say or do with your work. And so I was very happy to have achieved that. It offers some reward, just the act of applying. Getting it, obviously, quite phenomenal. Getting it during COVID, very interesting, I guess, in the sense that I got a lot of likes. But, you know, I haven't had many FaceTime conversations with people. So, you know, it's its own reward. And I'm very proud to have been honored with that.
Oh, well, I'm proud, too. It's well-deserved.
Thank you so much.
Of course. So speaking of what you were saying about applying for something of that scale can really help you hone what you're trying to do, because it forces you to communicate, you know, the idea behind your project clearer, and you have to write it well. And what is your elevator pitch?
Ooh, such a good and difficult question. Yeah, and I know now I hate them because, you know, it tries to reduce the complexity into something very small, but it is true that it's necessary. And, you know, the most glib or easily accessible elevator pitch might be that I photograph cities in transition. I look at the way urban life is shaped by people and how it shapes people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not really what I'm thinking about when I'm out shooting.
Yeah.
But it's it's something that sort of summarizes a little bit of my obsession. And I think a lot of that obsession was based on the fact that I was raised in a suburb, and I just longed for the intensity of an urban environment and the exchange of ideas and the fast pace that would come from them. I was thrilled by going to New York City for the first time when I was like 18, and I returned numerous times in the 80s, and I actually have another body of work that hopefully will become a book in the next year or so of images from New York City in the 80s. You know, it's like swimming in humanity. You know, yeah, I just like being surrounded by that kind of focused intensity that cities offer.
So if you could give a young artist advice on how to navigate the art world or build a career using photography, what would you tell them?
I'm probably not the best person to ask those questions about navigating the art world or monetizing your work. I would say the only monetizing I ever did was to become get an MFA and be able to teach at the college level for many years. And at this current state, I don't think that's really even viable.
Yeah.
The wages are like stuck back in the 80s, you know, and it's a travesty what it takes to make a living teaching art at this point. I have a partner that helps me out economically, or I would never have been able to have a house or children. So,
yeah, same.
You know, I didn't make work to make a product, and I think of my work as more of an idea than an object. I do like the objects, but I find them sort of secondary to the pursuit, which is to communicate some larger ideas. I've sort of born into the conceptual era of photography in the 70s, where the object itself was often disdained, while also having a lot of reverence for the perfection of a beautiful piece, right? And that dichotomy is quite taxing and intriguing at the same time. But you can only have so many pictures on the wall. So, you know, as far as making a living as an artist, mazel tov if you can do it. And some people do. And I'm very impressed if they can do it and in a way that feels that their work is true. Sometimes people make a lot of money over a short period of time and then that's it, you know, and then, you know, people interested in their work is gone. So you do have to look at the pursuit of art in the same way as you might any kind of philosophical or physical practice that you engage in on a daily basis. there's Thomas Kincaid, you know, he figured it out, right? I walked into somebody's house once and I said, I love this painting. This is fabulous. So, and it was like a reproduction of a Thomas Kincaid. I felt such the fool, right? I said, so there you go, right? So what do people put on their walls? You know, I kept thinking, would the tech people, you know, kind of create this huge demand for fine art once they got their apartments and had their babies and their furniture and their new technology? Would they then start coming into the galleries and wanting to support art because they're young and hip? And I don't think that it really happened that much. I think there are some indications of it, but I think that that kind of vocabulary, it's really a product of people who have old money and have, mm-hmm. you know, a kind of deep, long family historical relationship to spending the kind of money it takes to put, you know, objects on your wall that are, you know, that resonate with deep meaning for you, you know, as opposed to this matches the couch, you know.
Right. All right, Janet, thank you so much for being on the show, and have a good weekend.
Well, thanks so much. I appreciated all the good questions and the opportunity to share my thoughts.
All right, everyone. That wraps it up for episode 4 with Janet Delaney. I'm Carter Johnston, and next week we will be interviewing Kennedy Carter. So tune in then. In the meantime, have a good weekend.